This podcast is sponsored by the Center for International Business, Loyola University New Orleans College of Business.
Welcome to Gumbo of Opportunities, the podcast where we dive deep into the landscape of international business with a closer look at the state of Louisiana and New Orleans. We will hear stories, insights, and strategies of influential global players of the Bayou region in their pursuit to make the Bayou one of the most attractive areas for businesses. This is Gumbo of Opportunities. Hello everyone, I'm Alessandro.
Hello everyone, I'm Gustavo.
This is one of our last episodes of the first season of Gumbo of Opportunities.
Correct, correct.
And we think it's time to just reflect on the current state of the economy.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. This is a big first 100 days, give or take, on the new administration. Lots to talk about, so let's get rolling.
I mean, our Gumbo Opportunities is an international business podcast. We, so far throughout this year, we discussed about foreign direct investments. We discussed about macroeconomics, forces shaping economies, industries, within countries and across countries. We had the chance to interview amazing scholars discussing about innovation, entrepreneurship, discussing about knowledge spillovers, discussing about the importance of places, concept like entrepreneurial ecosystems. And of course, now we reach the end of the semester in which on different courses we teach about how businesses are doing, how businesses should take care of the environment, how businesses should scan day by day, moment by moment, the business environment to find possible threats, possible opportunities to catch. And so businesses today, international business in particular, but any type of business in reality, have to deal with a business context that today shows a high level of uncertainty.
Absolutely. What we observe today is policies that have reshuffle how markets are organized. It all starts, quite simply. It's amazing how one thing leads to another. It starts quite simply by the imposition of, barriers to international trade in the form of tariffs. Tariffs that are imposed in a way biased because they are not calculated using any economic theory. So it is it's a policy that initially was thought was not going to happen, but then I guess everybody got it wrong. And by everybody, I mean everybody. We observe in general terms, markets have declined significantly. Markets are down in the last, give or take, less than 100 days. We have lost trillions of dollars worth of investment. Companies have stopped, orders. Individuals are rushing to go and get the purchases before the prices get high. Levels of unemployment are starting to go up. We observed release data today on the GDP production to be negative. Most people expected it was going to be, close to zero, from a healthy 2.4, interannual growth to about 0.8. Came out to be negative 0.2, if I read correctly this morning. So now we are in a complete unexpected scenario. And again, we are limiting our conversation today to the economics in the international business dimensions of it, which is very interesting because throughout the first part of this cycle that we talk about, it was all up, 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 and we're talking about more market integration, talking about more free trade, a possibility for transferability of knowledge via foreign direct investment, expansion in terms of, employment, growth, and the list went on and on and on. Mm-hmm. Today, we find ourselves kind of in a 180. In fact, and I presume for you as well, Ali, in the classroom, all the class material that we had was in one direction, and now we have to go back the other way. But more importantly, what we observe is that the uncertainty that you mentioned becomes exacerbated when one day tariffs are up and next day then there's an exception and then they go back up and then you engage in retaliation. And so this is becoming something known as a race to the bottom. Let's see how low we can go. Let's see how long we can resist this. And what happens is, you know, you have the two large economies engaged in a fight and everybody else is watching from the side. It's trying to see, you know, what is going to happen. Yes, and so it creates severe, you know, uncertainty, and that uncertainty is quite difficult to comprehend, right?
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, especially because high level of uncertainty, as we know, scare off possible investments.
Indeed.
And that, of course, has a cascading effect across all the industries, mm-hmm. especially because we know now that every industry is very much integrated, both vertically and horizontally, mm-hmm. and it's also integrated across time and space.
Correct.
And correct. Contraction of one specific industry may be led through like an imposed of a specific tariff mm-hmm. also has important, significant, and negative effect across all industries. And so that's basically what we are looking at right now. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at right now at the latest projections of... Dow Industrial, Standard & Poor's 500, and NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. And there is high volatility. Yeah. We see a trend that is going up and down, as much as we open or close the stock exchange. Mm-hmm. And of course, that for investors is not something that something that today is expected, but something that should be avoided.
Correct, correct. I mean, at this semester, I was fortunate enough to teach a class on personal finance. And... when we first started the class, I was telling the students, hey, look at the market. Look how well the market is doing. You know, we're all green. It's been on the uptrend. And very soon it turned out to be we're going to go now in the red. And so we kept open in the classroom, you know, visuals to see how the market was performing and continuously look at, okay, the market went down today 2%, 5%, 10%. It kept on going negatively. And so it applied directly to the teaching. Students, you can see their concern of, you know, family now lost so much money on the retirement account. My grandparents are not going to retire yet. So we look at that. And then we start seeing other variables that are, you know, what we call the fundamentals. You know, and one of those fundamentals is the U.S. dollar that has been consistently the currency, I mean, post-World War II, consistently the safe, you know, safe reserved. Even the U.S. dollar has lost about 10%, you know, value against the euro. It has lost another 8% against the Swiss franc, and the list goes on and on. So even the dollar, that is the strong, you know, currency during difficult times, has now gone and retreat. And this indicates a lack of confidence internationally on whether the world can keep reserves using U.S. dollars. On the flip side, that makes U.S. products cheaper, and so it can counterbalance. But again, with higher tariffs, I think the game is going to be, you know, but we don't like a sum-zero game. So the
yeah, it's like a vicious cycle,
it
right?
It is a vicious cycle.
So you might get advantage of a lower value of dollar by improving export, but
correct.
On the other side, if you create obstacles to exports, then the type of short-term advantages mm-hmm. that you might get for having a lower, let's say, exchange rate for mm-hmm. your currency, and is get compromised by.
Correct.
By what basically the tariff are gonna take away in terms of value of product.
Correct. I mean, if you look at the theory in international finance, the fact that the U.S. dollar has devalued against other currencies has to be matched by inflation expectations. And we are starting to see that inflation in the next few days we're gonna have the newest, you know, value for it. But it is becoming the pressure on inflation in the U.S. is gonna start, you know, going up. Especially as, you know, the tariffs start, you know, taking place. Even with the exceptions, there's already shortages of some products that is going to increase, you know, the value of products. I mean, some people argue maybe a one-time shot, but it seems to be progressive. So here we have a combination of all the things that we don't like, right? We have inflation. We are now having negative growth in the GDP. That's known as stagflation. So there is no growth, and there is potential for inflation. This very quickly, very, very quickly leads to debates with the relationship between the government and the independent, and I want to emphasize independent Federal Reserve System. that is now, you know, facing pressures to lower interest rates when the time is not right to lower interest rates. So here the economic theory doesn't add up in this model of, you know, forced reindustrialization for low-value manufacturing in the U.S., and hence the objective of the tariffs to bring back some of these sectors is creating a spiral effect that leads to the things that we don't like, and that is inflation, that is unemployment, that is contraction. And of course, you know, when you start spicing this up with other elements, again, we're going to try to stay clear from those, but just to mention immigration policies that may be restrictive in terms of human capital, both creation, retention, and migration, then we observe all sorts of reconfiguration of, you know, where the world is going here. Let's remember that it wasn't that too far. I mean, it looks like it was ages ago, but it was not too long ago that we just came out of COVID. And COVID, you know, made it evident that there were some not missing, but weak links that if you...
There was already some distress in the market.
Correct. And the companies were able to sort that out, and they were pretty much back on track. I mean, we observed that China wasn't growing as fast as it was growing before. But now this is becoming much more disruptive because some of those channels are no longer there. When I say these channels are no longer there, it affects even close allies of the U.S. that have been also targeted by the tariffs, Mexico and Canada being the two most natural because they're part of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, formerly known as NAFTA. And so here, when you observe all these pieces moving at the same time, you know, it looks like it almost looked like when you go and agitate an anthill, and then ants run everywhere trying to see what the source of the problem is and how to solve the situation. So what we observe is a lot of uncertainty created. And more importantly, and I want to quote here the work that Jeffrey Sachs has done, and he has spoken recently. Same goes for Paul Krugman, is what is the objective of this? Because no one seems to be able to read clearly, not even, you know, investors in the stock markets, as you mentioned, you know, Standard & Poor's 500, Dow Jones Index. No one seems to know, you know, whether it's buy or sell. And then people are now holding large amounts of cash that they're not investing. So those, you know, trying to look for a safe haven also create, negative expectations in terms of, you know, where to put the money. Some are putting it in long-term, very long-term, you know, treasury bills just to play safe. But imagine what it's like. I mean, you know, you and I, we've been out doing this business for quite a long time, you know. I've been studying economics for over 40 years now, and I'm trying to make sense of all this. And it's just so complicated to understand. So explaining to students, this is the theory, but it doesn't work that way anymore because we're back into what we observed in the 1950s and 60s, which is forced import substitution industrialization, creates quite a challenging environment to understand, you know, where are we going? Because quite honestly, I'm not sure where we're going with this other than not good places. That feeling, that sense is pretty scary. And again, you and I, we are not owners of businesses. We're not investing. Imagine if you have to make the decisions to invest the money that somebody else entrusts you to conduct a business, and you have now to make a choice. I might not be able to sell the product if I invest in this company that happens to be located. And if I do, I might have to sell it at a significantly higher price.
Yeah.
So that is pretty, pretty challenging.
It's challenging, and my point of view on this take is that there are so many opportunities that we are not able to catch right now, because now investors are scared, because now entrepreneurs have to first look at the books, look at the investment plans, and say, okay, is there like a combination of investment that I can do that in some way protects my company against possible shocks that can happen like tomorrow, as like within 1 week and so. And there are so many opportunities out there. And I mean, even when we teach, we try to like share with students all the opportunities or the possibilities as we have for like spreading models of foreign direct investments mm-hmm. across emerging nations, across developing states, near-shoring, friend-shoring, creating vertical horizontal networks of collaboration mm-hmm. across markets and across industries, the potentiality of AI. And
correct.
An AI that is not a substitute of low-paid workers, but is like a tool, an instrument mm-hmm. that improves productivity.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if now investors are scared and have to reduce the level of exposure onto the market, I'm not sure that now they will look at those market opportunities, because at some point they will have to kind of like take the more prudent route, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct, absolutely correct. I mean, you mentioned several things that are very, very important. The one thing is, you know, you and I, we don't work on foreign direct investment, and we've seen the numbers. I mean, the numbers are what they are. And they're clearly indicating that companies that go abroad and maximize the potentiality of finding resources in other locations that are specific, either the place and or the clustering that firms create, and then, you know, the benefits of labor market pooling, enhance, you know, increase productivity with a very high certainty of getting the products back into the U.S., then leads to people, and let's just take a look from within the U.S., as consumers in the U.S. enjoying better products at a lower price, and that any day, all day, creates, you know, increases in welfare, you know, in well-being for our citizens. I hear the cry of some groups, of course, that some of the jobs that they used to do are no longer available. But that story we have also heard, you know, back in the 20s when the ag sector was contracting in terms of labor, but it was increasing exponentially in terms of productivity because technology allows us to move there. Well, same happened with manufacturing. There was a point where manufacturing certain products in the U.S. was not the cheapest way to go, and it was not the most productive either, so somebody else picked it up. Now we are in the knowledge era. And with Industry 4.0 and perhaps Industry 5.0, now what we have is that other countries have catch up in terms of education, and that leads to faster growth of technology and knowledge, which then positions us in a very good position to move into the services industry more. It's still with significant manufacturing taking place here in the U.S., but this then creates this difficult, you know, situation to explain to those that were left behind predominantly because of lack of access to education and or lack of maximization of the opportunities. I love music, as you know, and there's a few songs that I really like, and one of those is by Bruce Springsteen called Glory Days. And it took me a while, you know, because not being born here in the U.S., I didn't understand the phrase Glory Days. And Glory Days it refers to those high school days where the individual, you know, is either the superstar of the football team, or is the basketball player that achieves, you know, 1,000 points while in high school, and or brings the memories of going to prom and so on and so forth. And that's exactly what I think is happening here. We're trying to relive those glory days. The glory days where the U.S. manufacturing sector was the most dominant. It allowed a lot of people post-World War II to reach middle class and have a good life, you know, the land of opportunities, and have a house and have a car and put people through the educational system. Somehow, these policies of tariffs, to me, is a way to try to rebuild those glory days. Live today as if we were living in the past. That doesn't get us very far.
No. You mentioned something very important I was about to also to mention. It is about the concept of knowledge. As you said correctly, today we talk about knowledge more than we talk about individual products, mm-hmm. more than we talk about input and output in terms of like materiality. Mm-hmm. We talk more about knowledge because we know that we are in a knowledge economy.
Correct.
Right? So now knowledge is fundamental to create a sustained competitive advantage across, let's say, intra and inter-industry. Mm-hmm. thinking about knowledge, I just remember one article that I was reading a couple of days ago. It might be like earlier, but I mean, how it's important to keep investing in knowledge.
Absolutely.
No matter what can be your industrial policy, no matter if you want to like support a specific industry rather than others, no matter if you want to go back to burning coal instead of like supporting green economies, green energy production, that doesn't matter. The more important thing is that we cannot stop, we cannot slow down the accumulation of knowledge.
Absolutely.
And with what we discuss, with what we have available today as in terms of opportunities, what I think is fundamental is to remind us what China is doing. Mm-hmm. China, starting from, if I remember correctly, September 1st, 2025, they will start training 5 or 6 years old in schools in AI. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because they're recognizing that the knowledge, the use of knowledge, and so the abilities of students from very, very low age to deal with specific new advances in technology is the first fundamental step to support an economy.
You know, you're so right, Alex, because educating people is the ticket to, right? It is a human right, and we believe it here at Loyola, you know, the words of St. Ignatius where, you know, educate the whole person, right? So yes, we have to be educated just for the sake of education, but also because it makes us more productive. Back in 1776, Adam Smith came up with his, you know, great book, you know, The Wealth of the Nations, and in which the concepts of, you know, competitive, you know, comparative and absolute advantages were introduced. Then Ricardo in 1817, I believe, came up with the principles of economics, and then opportunity cost became an important concept. And then the idea of trade, you know, spins off from there very quickly, in which countries have a comparative advantage. But one of the things that Ricardo and Smith at the time did not talk about that much was that these comparative advantages are not static, but they're dynamic. And that means, you know, countries reposition themselves, or individuals reposition themselves through accumulation of resources. If it is a natural resource, then it's a natural resource. And we can think of, you know, the deposit of lithium in the 1776, 1821 were irrelevant. That didn't matter because we did not use lithium for anything. Today we use it, right? And so there is now a recombination that means location. But another thing that is important to understand is that certain countries, especially post-World War II, and Europe did it during the Industrial Revolution, but post-World War II, certain countries recognized that investment in education was a ticket to create comparative advantages. Predominantly, we observed the rise of Japan, and then nearby countries such as South Korea, and of course China, that has invested significantly in human capital. And we can debate all day long, whatever we want to debate in terms of which way they did it, but the point is they now have a much larger labor force that can do, you know, significant levels of investment. A few days back, I was listening to Tim Cook's, you know, CEO of Apple saying, look, we're getting this wrong. Yes, we went first to China because we thought that there was 1.2 billion people, all of them cheap labor, which that's not right. And the amount of cheap labor that is accessible is not 1.2, probably was more in the 300 to 400 million people, still a lot of people. But he said, but more importantly, when we go today to China, what happens is we can find, you know, thousands upon thousands of engineers that can do the work that we need. If we try to run a program like that here in the U.S., we'll be lucky if we get a few, 20 to 30 that show up. So that, you know, points out on a reconfiguration of, you know, those that are developing, you know, the skills necessary, which then takes us back to what I believe is the root of the problem for us, and that is how can we continue increasing human capital, bump up where we had the advantage, and that is on the high levels and availability of human capital. Of course, high school is important for everybody, and then colleges to continue advancing that creation of that key resource. I guess the game is very simple. People saw that in the U.S. educating people was a good thing, and they started educating people all over the place and commercializing those ideas. Hence, you fast forward, and what you have is a catch-up effect where no longer we are the most productive country in the world, and now we have to rethink how to do that. Once again, imposing barriers to trade seems to be a forced industrialization. I grew up during that era. It gives short-term live gains, so we might see some of that, but we also observe long-term, you know, decaying effects that tend to settle, you know, very quickly. Now, that leads, and I know we're about to run out of time, and we'll probably have to do another session for this, but that leads to two things that I truly hope that I'm wrong about this. And one is we're going to see a decrease in GDP in the U.S. in the next few months. That this is coming faster than I thought. I was with a group of economists that believed that we might have like a 1% growth in the last quarter. Now it's negative, so this is coming. You know, we're moving away from the eye of the storm, and the storm is hitting. And the second thing that I truly hope that I'm wrong about it is that we're going to hit double-digit inflation very quickly here in the U.S. My initial forecast was that by the end of the year, we'll be in double-digit. Given that we have negative growth now, I might have to rethink that, and probably by the end of the third quarter, we'll be close to double digit, and that, of course, implies that interest rates will have to be adjusted accordingly, and that means interest rates go up, and that's not going to be a pretty picture, especially for people trying to undertake a project, people that want to buy a new house, people that need to refinance some sort of debt. Not the brightest of the brightest short term and medium term future is what I see here.
You mentioned something very interesting, even though you did not use the technical term of it. I know that you were thinking about that. And you mentioned in your discourse the concept of the first movers.
Indeed.
A concept that, we use in our courses in many, many different, with different focuses. I mean, you can use that thinking about the financial market. You can use that as part of your, let's say, work on economics and discussing about how economy shape throughout countries and across nations. You can also use that speaking about strategy. Mm-hmm. And so if we think about strategy, being first mover is essential. Mm-hmm. And focusing on those elements of the economy that used to be essential, but you mentioned the work of Adam Smith, you mentioned the work of Ricardo, great economists, but I mean, scenarios were dramatically different at the time. Today, globalization forced a connection across market.
Yes, absolutely.
A connection cannot be broken today. There is no condition, there is no way we can have countries that self-isolate.
No.
Because everything is connected. You teach a great course which speaks of the global connection of supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
If the supply chain is integrated vertically, horizontally, across continents, how can you isolate economies if not, creating serious damages to industries? Mm-hmm. Burning millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, of investments.
Yes.
So I hope that we are not looking for measures of self-isolation, mm-hmm. with the idea of pushing something that might not be the best strategy for our economy here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you speak, there's, you know, when you study economics and business, there's a few concepts that we hone in as students over and over again. Repetition matters. And these concepts are those of trade creation and trade diversion. These policies that we're observing today, based on my research and a couple of papers published on the subject matter, they look to me, they sound to me, they walk like trade diversion. We might increase trade among ourselves, but it's not going to be, you know, trade that is going to make us be better off in the long term. So I think this is one of those scenarios where trade diversion is kicking in. trade diversion, misallocate resources. It does result in trade because you produce, but you now buy from those that are not the most optimal producers. And hence, bottom line is individuals will have to pay more, and that is going to result in lower standards of living, perhaps with products all made here, but with lower quality of life in the long term.
Yeah, I think it's what we teach. If something is not does not have a specific competitive advantage to be produced in a specific nation, it doesn't make sense to force its production because others can produce it with lower costs and even selling us the same product, we might have a greater demand for it. So, of course, if the price is lower, that could support a demand. Therefore, we shouldn't force the production of products that are not that does not have competitive advantage because of the combination of factors of production. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. The cost of human capital, the cost and availability of resources. Earlier, you were mentioning something that makes me wonder. You were mentioning about lithium, maybe.
Yeah.
Like who needed lithium like 70 years ago, right?
Yeah.
80 years ago. And now imagine that, for example, for any type of technological application, any type of, I don't know, you're buying a smartphone, you're buying the new gaming console or whatever, you're buying the new graphic accelerator mm-hmm. to play with maps, to play simulation, to engage with enormous, ginormous actually amount of data mm-hmm. Just to, you know, to create a forecast, to create business scenarios and to see how the economy is going to be within like 5 to 10 years or mm-hmm. even like in 1 month. And you need what? You need lithium. You need cobalt.
Cobalt.
You need nickel.
Nickel, copper, gold.
There's a couple of that. I'm not sure I pronounce correctly. Like boron.
Yeah, there's a couple of names there. That
manganese.
Magnesium? Manganese, yeah.
And all these, and some of those are also called those rare minerals that are yes. often at the center of national or international disputes.
Correct.
And, I mean, I guess we really need to go back to the fundament of the economy and really look at those very, very easy, simple things that makes an economy work. Mm-hmm. Not that it is easy to make an economy work, of course.
Absolutely. I mean, I would not like to be in a public yes. office trying to make decisions right now, yeah.
But we really need to, I guess, face globalization, not fight it. Mm-hmm. Face the new technological advances, integrate them as much as possible in order to improve and keep pushing the knowledge economy. Mm-hmm. Instead, my guess would be going back to an economy that is just connected to the gathering of input and resources.
Correct. You know, that issue is, you know, I guess something that we've been watching for a few years, and is the process of deglobalization in favor of more regionalism. And that has, you know, taken place. And there's some logic to it. Firms tend to expand close to markets that are closer to home. Of course, there is plenty that have gone across Atlantic, across Pacific. But that's just part of, you know, the process of integration and access to markets, you know, accounting for distance. Regionalism to a certain extent is expected, but that regionalism is also international trade. What we're observing here is an actual retreat. You know, this is not just a natural course, it's a retreat full force that creates a change in the game and consequently the gains that we have observed across the globe in terms of trade, in terms of investment, in terms of poverty reduction across the globe, which are some of the benefits of globalization. We might putting those in jeopardy. Now, I'm not saying globalization is always good. There are things about globalization that are not good, and those need to be accounted for as well. But that's not enough to justify that then we want to shut it down and move away from it. I think the perception of the U.S. economy in the world is changing. And to me, that is being reflected in the value of the U.S. dollar declining. I'm a strong believer that the U.S. had and has had an advantage over most other countries in the world because everybody wanted to hold U.S. dollars. And that holding of U.S. dollars has allowed the U.S. dollar to have a very expansionary monetary policy without suffering from inflation, which will be the immediate consequence of, you know, that printing. I'm afraid we're losing that. I'm afraid that people are moving away and realizing that they have too much exposure in one currency. And if they decide to dump the U.S. dollar, then it becomes a serious problem for us, because we lose that capability that has been, that is the capability that the country that prints the currency by excellence of trade has over anybody else. So I think we're reaching the end. We can't have a second round to it.
Yeah. I guess we can keep the topic of perceptions, the topic of the strong connection between how markets are performing today.
Yeah.
With all the recent, changes in politics, not just in U.S. but internationally, also European Union is playing a big like game in terms of internal politics mm-hmm. of the EU.
Correct.
With with power that is shifting from historically stronger state like France and Germany mm-hmm. towards countries that were able to recreate a sort of strong right-wing politics, like, for example, Italy.
Italy and now Germany a little bit, and very dangerous. You know, we bring the word fascism again with these divisive policies. And that's a chapter that we should talk, extensively on itself. And maybe we should bring a third person that will help us with the politics of it, but that's very dangerous. That's a place. It's a dark part of history that we shouldn't go back to. We should have learned the not the good things that come out of that. Strong swing to extremes. And yes, it is pretty dangerous. Now, what do we recommend people to do in these very unstable times? Here's my two or three takeaways. One is don't panic. Right? Now, don't panic, but be informed. Take a look at the markets, follow the markets, understand, what is happening. Reassess your budget, what is a necessity, what is not, what is something that could be postponed if you don't have to do those needs. If you are a homeowner, do not engage in refinancing. The interest rates are going to go up again. Try to postpone unnecessary expenses. Try to build up again part of your retirement fund. Continue listening to the news day in, day out. Do what is the responsibility of a citizen to speak when speaking is necessary. Let's continue working on the institutions that we have in this country, believing that democracy is going to lead us to expressing our voices the best way possible. Midterm elections are coming up soon, so elections are important as well. Voting is a right that we should exercise, and that is a way that we can contribute. Keep working, and that's a very important ability that we have, and continue to be as productive as possible, and if possible, continue being educated in new skills.
Well, I can add something. You mentioned something already, but I can add, if you're looking at financial product, please diversify as much as possible, so you will reduce your overall risk, mm-hmm. especially in this moment. And don't stop. Educate yourself.
Absolutely.
That is particularly my message to our students. To every student that is in the audience here. So never stop. Educate yourself. Never stop being curious.
Yes.
And I always like to look back at our Jesuit values. Mm-hmm. Build your global mindset, be curious, emphasize ethics,
yes.
faith, justice, social justice, mm-hmm. And work, build your own intellectual growth.
Absolutely. And so, all those values, the Jesuit values, are very important to be pushed in this during these times. As we said, we touch about one or two subjects here. There is more that we can speak about. And I would like to finish by, thanking everybody for your attention, but also asking all of you to say a prayer for the next Pope, in that Pope Francis may rest in peace and bless us, from above, in that we can continue searching, ways for peace and prosperity in understanding among all nations and all individuals for a better world.
Yeah, and I guess this is our last episode for season one of Gumbo Opportunities.
Yes,
so we will also take a break.
Yes, it is a pleasure to be here this first year. And I have to say, I'm going to throw Ali under the bus to celebrate Alessandro's birthday today. So happy birthday to Alessandro.
Thank you.
And thank you for all the work that you do for us, for the center. And it is truly, truly valuable, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks a lot. I mean, it's a pleasure. It's an honor and a pleasure at the same time. And we will see, I mean, I hope to see and to have any feedback from you all next season of Gumbo Opportunities that will start again next September. So let's all take a break. Let's recharge. Let's just see what happens in the meantime and just be ready for season two of Gumbo Opportunities, because we have already a lineup of people.
Absolutely.
That I'm sure you will enjoy listening and they will bring value to our podcast.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, Alessandro.
Thank and you,
everyone,
Gustavo.
Take care.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Gumbo of Opportunities, the podcast about international business of Southern Louisiana and New Orleans. Huge thanks to Farah, Oban, and all the staff involved for making this podcast possible. The music is New Orleans Jazz Guitar Music by The Music Hive.